Chapter 3. Wherein certain persons are presented to the reader, with whom he may, if he please, become better acquainted. It was pretty late in the autumn of the year, when the declining sun, struggling through the mist which had obscured it all day, looked brightly down upon a little Wiltshire village, within an easy journey of the fair old town of Salisbury. Like a sudden flash of memory or spirit kindling up the mind of an old man, it shed a glory upon the scene, in which its departed youth and freshness seemed to live again. The wet grass sparkled in the light, the scanty patches of verdure in the hedges, where a few green twigs yet stood together bravely, resisting to the last the tyranny of nipping winds, and early frosts took heart and brightened up. The stream which had been dull and sullen all day long broke out into a cheerful smile. The birds began to chirp and twitter on the naked boughs, as though the hopeful creatures half believed that winter had gone by and spring had come already. The vane upon the tapering spire of the old church glistened from its lofty station in sympathy with the general gladness, and from the ivy-shaded windows such gleams of light shone back upon the glowing sky, that it seemed as if the quiet buildings were the hoarding place of 20 summers, and all their ruddiness and warmth were stored within. Even those tokens of the season which emphatically whispered of the coming winter, graced the landscape, and, for the moment, tinged its livelier features with no oppressive air of sadness. The fallen leaves, with which the ground was strewn, gave forth a pleasant fragrance, and subduing all harsh sounds of distant feet and wheels created a repose in gentle unison with the light scattering of seed hither and thither by the distant husbandman, and with the noiseless passage of the plough as it turned up the rich brown earth, and wrought a graceful pattern in the stubbled fields. On the motionless branches of some trees, autumn berries hung like clusters of coral beads, as in those fabled orchards, where the fruits were jewels. Others, stripped of all their garniture, stood, each the center of its little heap of bright red leaves, watching their slow decay. Others again, still wearing theirs, had them all crunched and crackled up, as though they had been burnt. About the stems of some were piled, in ruddy mounds, the apples they had borne that year, while others, hardy evergreens this class, showed somewhat stern and gloomy in their vigor, as charged by nature with the admonition, that it is not to her more sensitive and joyous favorites she grants the longest term of life. Still athwart their darker boughs, the sunbeams struck out paths of deeper gold, and the red light, mantling in among their swarthy branches, used them as foils to set its brightness off, and ate the luster of the dying day. A moment, and its glory was no more. The sun went down beneath the long dark lines of hill and cloud which piled up in the west an airy city, wall heaped on wall, and battlement on battlement. The light was all withdrawn. The shining church turned cold and dark. The stream forgot to smile, the birds were silent, and the gloom of winter dwelt on everything. An evening wind uprose too, and the slighter branches cracked and rattled as they moved, in skeleton dances, to its moaning music. The withering leaves, no longer quiet, hurried to and fro in search of shelter from its chill pursuit. The laborer unyoked his horses, and with head bent down, trudged briskly home beside them. And from the cottage windows lights began to glance and wink upon the darkening fields. Then the village forge came out in all its bright importance. The lusty bellows roared ha-ha to the clear fire, which roared in turn, and bade the shining sparks dance gaily to the merry clinking of the hammers on the anvil. The gleaming iron, in its emulation, sparkled too, and shed its red-hot gems around profusely. The strong smith and his men dealt such strokes upon their work, as made even the melancholy night rejoice, and brought a glow into its dark face as it hovered about the door and windows, peeping curiously in above the shoulders of a dozen loungers. As to this idle company, there they stood, spellbound by the place, and, casting now and then a glance upon the darkness in their rear, settled their lazy elbows more at ease upon the sill, and leaned a little further in. no more disposed to tear themselves away than if they had been born to cluster round the blazing hearth like so many crickets. Out upon the angry wind, how from sighing, it began to bluster round the merry forge, banging at the wicket, and grumbling in the chimney, as if it bullied the jolly bellows for doing anything to order. And what an impotent swaggerer it was too, for all its noise, for if it had any influence on that hoarse companion, it was but to make him roar his cheerful song the louder, and by consequence to make the fire burn the brighter, and the sparks to dance more gaily yet. At length, they whizzed so madly round and round, that it was too much for such a surly wind to bear. So off it flew with a howl, giving the old sign before the alehouse door such a cuff as it went, that the blue dragon was more rampant than usual ever afterwards, and indeed, before Christmas, reared clean out of its crazy frame. It was small tyranny for a respectable wind to go wreaking its vengeance on such poor creatures as the fallen leaves, but this wind happening to come up with a great heap of them, just after venting its humor on the insulted dragon, did so disperse and scatter them, that they fled away, pell-mell, some here, some there, rolling over each other, whirling round and round upon their thin edges, taking frantic flights into the air, and playing all manner of extraordinary gambols in the extremity of their distress. Nor was this enough for its malicious fury, for not content with driving them abroad, it charged small parties of them, and hunted them into the wheelwright's saw pit, and below the planks and timbers in the yard, and, scattering the sawdust in the air, it looked for them underneath, and when it did meet with any, whew, how it drove them on and followed at their heels. The scared leaves only flew the faster for all this, and a giddy chase it was, for they got into unfrequented places, where there was no outlet, and where their pursuer kept them eddying round and round at his pleasure, and they crept under the eaves of houses, and clung tightly to the sides of hayricks, like bats, and tore in at open chamber windows, and cowered close to hedges, and, in short, went anywhere for safety. But the oddest feat they achieved was to take advantage of the sudden opening of Mr. Pecksniff's front door, to dash wildly into his passage, whither the wind following close upon them, and finding the back door open, incontinently blew out the lighted candle held by Miss Pecksniff, and slammed the front door against Mr. Pecksniff, who was at that moment entering, with such violence, that in the twinkling of an eye he lay on his back at the bottom of the steps. Being by this time weary of such trifling performances, the boisterous rover hurried away rejoicing, roaring over moor and meadow, hill and flat, until it got out to sea, where it met with other winds similarly disposed, and made a night of it. In the meantime Mr. Pecksniff, having received from a sharp angle in the bottom step but one, that sort of knock on the head which lights up, for the patient's entertainment, an imaginary general illumination of very bright short sixes, lay placidly staring at his own street door. And it would seem to have been more suggestive in its aspect than street doors usually are, for he continued to lie there, rather a lengthy and unreasonable time, without so much as wondering whether he was heard or no, neither when Miss Pecksniff inquired through the keyhole in a shrill voice, which might have belonged to a wind in its teens, who's there, did he make any reply, nor when Miss Pecksniff opened the door again, and shading the candle with her hand, peered out, and looked provokingly round him, and about him, and over him, and everywhere but at him, did he offer any remark, or indicate in any manner the least hint of a desire to be picked up. "I see you," apostrophe cried Miss Pecksniff, to the ideal inflictor of a runaway knock. "You'll catch it, sir," apostrophe still Mr. Pecksniff, perhaps from having caught it already, said nothing. "You're round the corner now," apostrophe cried Miss Pecksniff. She said it at a venture, but there was appropriate matter in it too, for Mr. Pecksniff, being in the act of extinguishing the candles before mentioned pretty rapidly, and of reducing the number of brass knobs on his street door from 400 or 500, which had previously been juggling of their own accord before his eyes in a very novel manner, to a dozen or so, might in one sense have been said to be coming round the corner, and just turning it. With a sharply delivered warning relative to the cage and the constable, and the stocks and the gallows, Miss Pecksniff was about to close the door again, when Mr. Pecksniff, being still at the bottom of the steps, raised himself on one elbow, and sneezed. That voice! Apostrophe, apostrophe, cried Miss Pecksniff. My parent! Apostrophe, at this exclamation, another Miss Pecksniff bounced out of the parlor. And the two Miss Pecksniffs, with many incoherent expressions, dragged Mr. Pecksniff into an upright posture. Pa! Apostrophe, apostrophe, they cried in concert. Pa! Speak, Pa! Do not look so wild, my dearest Pa! Apostrophe, apostrophe, but as a gentleman's looks, in such a case of all others, are by no means under his own control, Mr. Pecksniff continued to keep his mouth and his eyes very wide open, and to drop his lower jaw, somewhat after the manner of a toy nutcracker, and as his hat had fallen off, and his face was pale, and his hair erect, and his coat muddy, the spectacle he presented was so very doleful, that neither of the Miss Pecksniffs could repress an involuntary screech. That'll do, apostrophe, said Mr. Pecksniff. I'm better. Apostrophe, he's come to himself. Apostrophe, apostrophe, cried the youngest Miss Pecksniff. He speaks again. Apostrophe, apostrophe, exclaimed the eldest. With these joyful words they kissed Mr. Pecksniff on either cheek, and bore him into the house. Presently, the youngest Miss Pecksniff ran out again, to pick up his hat, his brown paper parcel, his umbrella, his gloves, and other small articles. And that done, and the door closed, both young ladies applied themselves to tending Mr. Pecksniff's wounds in the back parlor. They were not very serious in their nature, being limited to abrasions on what the eldest Miss Pecksniff called the knobby parts of her parent's anatomy, such as his knees and elbows, and to the development of an entirely new organ, unknown to phrenologists, on the back of his head. These injuries having been comforted externally, with patches of pickled brown paper, and Mr. Pecksniff having been comforted internally, with some stiff brandy and water, the eldest Miss Pecksniff sat down to make the tea, which was all ready. In the meantime the youngest Miss Pecksniff brought from the kitchen a smoking dish of ham and eggs, and, setting the same before her father, took up her station on a low stool at his feet, thereby bringing her eyes on a level with the tea board. It must not be inferred from this position of humility that the youngest Miss Pecksniff was so young as to be, as one may say, forced to sit upon a stool, by reason of the shortness of her legs. Miss Pecksniff sat upon a stool, because of her simplicity and innocence, which were very great, very great. Miss Pecksniff sat upon a stool, because she was all girlishness, and playfulness, and wildness, and kittenish buoyancy. She was the most arch, and at the same time the most artless creature, was the youngest Miss Pecksniff, that you can possibly imagine. It was her great charm. She was too fresh and guileless, and too full of childlike vivacity, was the youngest Miss Pecksniff, to wear combs in her hair, or to turn it up, or to frizzle it, or braid it. She wore it in a crop, a loosely flowing crop, which had so many rows of curls in it, that the top row was only one curl. Moderately buxom was her shape, and quite womanly too. But sometimes, yes, sometimes she even wore a pinafore. And how charming that was! Oh! She was indeed a gushing thing, as a young gentleman had observed in verse, in the poet's corner of a provincial newspaper, was the youngest Miss Pecksniff. Mr. Pecksniff was a moral man, a grave man, a man of noble sentiments and speech, and he had at her christened Mercy. Mercy! Oh, what a charming name for such a pure-souled being as the youngest Miss Pecksniff! Her sister's name was Charity. There was a good thing. Mercy and Charity. And Charity, with her fine strong sense and her mild, yet not reproachful gravity, was so well named, and did so well set off and illustrate her sister. What a pleasant sight was that the contrast they presented. To see each loved and loving one sympathizing with, and devoted to, and leaning on, and yet correcting and counter-checking, and, as it were, antidoting, the other. To behold each damsel in her very admiration of her sister, setting up in business for herself on an entirely different principle, and announcing no connection with over the way, and if the quality of goods at that establishment don't please you, you are respectfully invited to favor me with a call. And the crowning circumstance of the whole delightful catalogue was, that both the fair creatures were so utterly unconscious of all this. They had no idea of it. They no more thought or dreamed of it than Mr. Pecksniff did. Nature played them off against each other. They had no hand in it, the two Miss Pecksniffs. It has been remarked that Mr. Pecksniff was a moral man. So he was. Perhaps there never was a more moral man than Mr. Pecksniff, especially in his conversation and correspondence. It was once said of him by a homely admirer that he had a fortunatus's purse of good sentiments in his inside. In this particular he was like the girl in the fairy tale, except that if they were not actual diamonds which fell from his lips, they were the very brightest paste, and shone prodigiously. He was a most exemplary man, fuller of virtuous precept than a copybook. Some people likened him to a direction post, which is always telling the way to a place, and never goes there. But these were his enemies, the shadows cast by his brightness. That was all. His very throat was moral. You saw a good deal of it. You looked over a very low fence of white cravat whereof no man had ever beheld the tie, for he fastened it behind, and there it lay, a valley between two jutting heights of collar, serene and whiskerless before you. It seemed to say, on the part of Mr. Pecksniff, there is no deception, ladies and gentlemen, all is peace, a holy calm pervades me. Apostrophe so did his hair, just grizzled with an iron gray which was all brushed off his forehead, and stood bolt upright, or slightly drooped in kindred action with his heavy eyelids. So did his person, which was sleek, though free from corpulency. So did his manner, which was soft and oily. In a word, even his plain black suit, and state of widower and dangling double eyeglass, all tended to the same purpose, and cried aloud, "Behold the moral Pecksniff!" Apostrophe, apostrophe, the brazen plate upon the door, which being Mr. Pecksniff's, could not lie, bore this inscription, "Pecksniff, architect," apostrophe to which Mr. Pecksniff, on his cards of business, added, "and land surveyor." Apostrophe in one sense, and only one, he may be said to have been a land surveyor on a pretty large scale, as an extensive prospect lay stretched out before the windows of his house. Of his architectural doings, nothing was clearly known, except that he had never designed or built anything, but it was generally understood that his knowledge of the science was almost awful in its profundity. Mr. Pecksniff's professional engagements, indeed, were almost, if not entirely, confined to the reception of pupils, for the collection of rents, with which pursuit he occasionally varied and relieved his graver toils, can hardly be said to be a strictly architectural employment. His genius lay in ensnaring parents and guardians, and pocketing premiums. A young gentleman's premium being paid, and the young gentleman come to Mr. Pecksniff's house, Mr. Pecksniff borrowed his case of mathematical instruments, if silver mounted or otherwise valuable, and treated him, from that moment, to consider himself one of the family, complimented him highly on his parents or guardians, as the case might be, and turned him loose in a spacious room on the two-pair front, where, in the company of certain drawing boards, parallel rulers, very stiff-legged compasses, and two, or perhaps three, other young gentlemen, he improved himself, for 3 or 5 years, according to his articles, in making elevations of Salisbury Cathedral from every possible point of sight, and in constructing in the air a vast quantity of castles, houses of parliament, and other. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.